They aren't necessarily really giving much thought to what they put out there, just doing their thing. And they're just a reflection of their society at the time. And it's like, someone who reflects the general prevailing attitude of a society is not going to get canceled. You can't get, if you know, some and any vocal, you know, individual or small group of people trying to get them canceled would get no traction because the society at large would agree with them because they're reflecting that society. It's when people get canceled when what they've done or said moves beyond the pale, or when society evolves and leaves them behind and they don't make any effort to catch up.
Yeah. I concur with that. And the awakening, or I don't want to say awakening, but all the marching and everything that's happening now, I hope that it leads and paves the way for a more in-depth conversation, but most importantly, direct action. And hopefully there are people out there and they'll be calling the police department to get the officers locked up that killed Breonna Taylor. So on that note, I'd like to say thank you, Portland and the world and the galaxies, and we'll be back next week. I'm Tammy, and Althea, thank you. Sonia, thank you. This is The Gap.
Thank you.
See ya.
This is KEOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. KBOO continues broadcasting, bringing you the best of what's out there. So stay tuned.
This moment is pivotal. Crucial, critical, our opponent is intentional. Brutally criminal, to be truthful, our response has been useful and pitiful. Community defense happens when we control the city, though. Perversity, virtually, worshiping emergencies, a constant state of urgency. Crisis creates currency, mass murder and the mayhem, massacres and strife, manufacturing the chaos, the fascist race is right. Merchants peddle weaponry and sell it to all sides. No guarantees with no tranquility after we all die. Hostility, rage and anger killing me. Make them in atrocities, plausible deniability. We must achieve the impossible, believe in our abilities. I'ma look to you and me, not Hollywood or Hillary. Politicians and police, gatekeeping bourgeoisie. Liberation's closer than you think, but y'all ain't really feeling me. It's time to think fast, the movement. Learn lessons from my past, the movement. Organize the class, the movement. Solidarity at last, the movement. And yo, we gotta think fast, the movement. Learn lessons from my past, the movement.
I am joined today by local hip-hop artist Mike Crenshaw, and Mike has also been a longtime activist here in Portland and originally out of Minneapolis. So, of course, the recent events are probably making some connections for you there, Mike. I know one of the early protests, people were saying, you know, Portland is a lot like Minneapolis as far as demographics, as far as history of police violence and racism. And I wonder if you can talk about your experience with both of those cities and what's happening right now with the protests.
Yeah, this has been really visceral for me, because when I woke up on the morning of the 26th of May, I think it was, where the first thing I watched was the video on my phone of George Floyd. And it was a long enough video to where I didn't realize he was going to die, even though it was horrible, the abuse and the violence that they subjected him to. I still was like, well, at some point they're going to get off of him. I mean, why not? And I watched that video, and beyond the murder that I witnessed, the lynching and the brutality, was this recollection of what 38th in Chicago feels like at this time of year, because I've spent a lot of time in that neighborhood, and I know what the heat and the humidity, little pieces of gum stuck to the sidewalk and all that stuff feels like right there. And immediately, like, I felt a deep sense of empathy for not only George Floyd, but for what I sensed the city was going through. And then I was pleasantly surprised with the swiftness with which the uprising took hold, because I thought, you know, this can't stand. And so I was proud. I'm proud of Minneapolis. You know, people want to talk about nuances regarding provocateurs and opportunists and all that. That's part of the narrative, but I never lose sight of the central part of the narrative, the most important part of the narrative, which is that Black and Brown people in that community stood up and said enough is enough, as they should have. And that's what sparked a global rebellion. Growing up there, you know, I spent the first part of my childhood in Chicago, in Illinois, a couple other communities in Illinois, and then I wound up moving up to St. Paul, and then ultimately landed in Minneapolis to go to high school. And so I was there in my teenage years, and those were the years at which, as an adolescent, I was out on the street having encounters with police. And there's a few, you know, I have some pretty traumatic stories. One is I went to a party with some friends, and we got jumped by these white guys, these racists, at this party. And we had to, there were about six of us and about 40 of them. We had to fight our way out. And one of them hit me with a bat, and I was able to get the bat from him. And at that point, I was defending all of us with the bat. And as this was transpiring, the police came up the alley, a series of cruisers with their lights off. And I ran down the alley away from them, and as soon as I got around the corner of the garage, there were maybe five or six police with their guns and flashlights on me, and they proceeded to beat me pretty viciously. They handcuffed me, and they would lift me up off the ground. I immediately went on the ground on my stomach and put my hands behind my head, because I knew that was a position to assume to get them to understand that I was compliant. But they handcuffed me, and they lift me up just to where I thought I could get my footing, and then they'd slam me back down on the ground. They did this over and over again as they beat me with flashlights and billy clubs. And so a crowd had gathered, and they were calling me nigger and, you know, swearing at me. And I remember thinking, I don't know if I'm going to make it home. So I, you know, that's just one occasion. I learned to fear the police, not in an irrational way, but in a practical way. I learned that they didn't care for my life. They didn't respect my life, and they might well end my life if I continue to have encounters with them. Now in Portland, where I moved out here to when I was 22, I've mostly just been pulled over. I haven't actually been violently assaulted, but I've often been pulled over because I fit a description, so to speak. You know, they just want to harass a Black man. I've often been pulled over just for making eye contact with them and holding my space. And so those are my experiences, and I know that these are common experiences for so many of us Black folks. And I have a lot of faith in the resilience of our people and the ever evolving political consciousness of our people in light of what has been made apparent by this recent series of police murders. And it's just crazy because it hasn't stopped. They're still killing people, you know. And then in light of this, we're starting to see many other murders come, you know, into the public sphere as far as our awareness that we, people all over the country, haven't even been aware of. And you get to see these things, you know, these cops will say shit like, say things like, excuse me with the language, they'll say things like, you know, that's not in our training. But when you see multiple police departments doing the exact same maneuvers where they're putting a knee on the neck and they have other people restraining somebody's limbs, if you're not trying to kill somebody or maim somebody, what exactly are you trying to do?
Yeah. I mean, when you just describe that, it's so visceral, like you could have been George Floyd.
Yeah. I remember in my body wanted to fight and defend myself because I was fleeing for survival from a racist attack. And I fled into the, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire, right? So now these police are going to kill me. And I remember thinking, knowing I had a right to survive the encounter that I just experienced, knowing I was in the right to defend myself. But now my life is being threatened, and the pain and the trauma of the moment and me going, my body telling me to fight back, you know, and me having to do this crazy, like, psychic override to, like, force myself to not defend myself. And to still, not, like, to know that, like, if I actually defend myself now, death is certain. And that if I just lay here and take it, so to speak, I might survive. And me saying, I remember thinking that if I defend myself, they're going to kill me. And they might kill me if I don't defend myself. And what's my mom going to hear? They're going to tell my mother that I had drugs on me, or that I had a gun on me, or something. So I know, I feel like I know what George was going through and what so many of us go through. And that's something that is unbelievable to so many people, but it's so common and understood by those of us who've experienced it.
Yeah. Wow. So now we have this movement, this uprising, and, you know, this movement started after the murder of George Floyd and, of course, Breonna Taylor, and people quickly went to abolish the police, but that's now changed to defund the police. And here in Portland, the biggest push that was made was for a cut to the Portland police by what amounts to about 7% of their budget mm-hmm. from last year. It seems like some people are maybe satisfied with that. And I wonder if you could talk about what you see as the difference between abolition and reform and which way we should be pushing.
You know, we always want to push for our wildest dream, the best case scenario, the highest possible potential outcome. So if you were to ask me, here's a metaphor, you want to do with your life, I love travel. So, you know, now things are changing. We don't know how accessible travel is going to be for people who aren't extremely privileged, right? But as a dreamer and as a younger person, I'd be like, I want to travel. And so in my mind, if I thought, well, what would be the ultimate, you know, manifestation of my wildest desires as far as travel? I want to see every country in every region, you know, in every ecosystem, in every climate, in every geographical location. I want to see all of it and experience all of it. So let's take that kind of vision I might have for myself and my wildest dreams, and let's impose that on this whole question of reform versus revolution, because abolition would be something that would be part of a revolutionary change and shift in civilization and society. That would be the highest aspirational goal. Let's get rid of the toxic, deadly, predatory, oppressive forces in our communities that threaten our very existence on a day-to-day basis, especially in poor working class communities, Black communities, communities of color, indigenous communities, Latinx communities, people who are marginalized for their mental health status, their economic status, their sexual orientation, their gender, you know, whatever it is, the ways that the police are interacting are to serve and protect the interests of the wealthy and the elite. And our lives are just fodder. We're collateral damage. So I want to get rid of that at the highest end of what my desires would be. Now, the reality of it is that a revolutionary change that would abolish not only the police, but all the violent systems of extraction and oppression that of which the police are one, is what I would hope humanity could achieve at some point. What we know is the reform, I think, is a concession-based set of activities and intentions and projects that have to do with this increment, these ideas about incremental change and trying to hold on to as much of the status quo as one can and just change and tweak little bits and pieces of it to make it feel less threatening. And I think that the reason that happens is because many of us, for a multi-generational timeline, you know, chronologically speaking, we don't have a memory of anything but what we've experienced in this society. So we don't know what it feels like to not have the police. And we've been indoctrinated with so much propaganda and social conditioning that we've been trained to believe that the police are our necessity. And we can't recollect the time when the police didn't exist and where people had other ways of organizing to defend their communities and to hold people accountable as far as things that were threats to our lives and our safety. So what we need to do is envision something different and do the work of organizing so that once these systems are transformed and these police are not in our communities, that we have actually set into place measures and ways of organizing to protect and take care of ourselves. And that is going to take time, and I think a lot of people are not ready for that. They think that abolition is too radical of an idea, and it scares people who just haven't been spending time visualizing and imagining a different world, you know. And I think it's easier for people to, this is funny, I say this quote so much, and I don't know who initially said it. I think I heard it from my comrade Sherry Hunkler at one point. She might have got it from Reverend Barbara, I don't know, but that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And so I say capitalism because it's this relation that private property and wealth has to the masses that mandates the police forces and the military forces to be used to control the population. And the violence is their tool. Violence and repression is their tool. And to me, it's heinous. And to me, I know, like, yeah, there are people out here who are doing bad things to other people, but I do believe that if we could remove the central underlying core problematic entities, then people would learn in that process how to be better human beings towards each other, because we wouldn't be so aligned with this sickness that uses violence as its only means of operation. So that there's going to be people in my community who look like me, who are friends and comrades, who are going to settle for reform because it feels like progress to them. And it's not my job to discredit them or disrespect them, or say bad things about them publicly. You know, it's my job to say, okay, if that's all you can put your energy towards right now, then go ahead and do that. But the rest of us who are pushing towards something more revolutionary are going to continue pushing for that. And I hope that at some point in time that our efforts can coordinate and there can be more alignment and solidarity, because ultimately it just makes logical sense that if there's a violent threat in our community to our lives, that we would want to figure out ways to remove that. And right now, I see that as the police.
The violent threat to our community.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's clear as day. Yeah, there are people out here because of capitalism, because of poverty, because of economic hardship. There are people out here who are stealing things from each other. There are people out here who are hurting each other because they've been forced to be in competition with each other and view each other as threats. But that's because of capitalism. That's the root cause of that, to me. Some people will say, well, no, humans are just conditioned to be that way. There are always going to be sociopaths, and there are always going to be predator and prey and so on and so forth. And I'm like, okay, that's part of the human condition, but that part of the human condition is reinforced by other relationships that are dominant in society. And if you remove those things that are forced upon us that cause the dysfunction, then there's an opportunity for us to behave differently.
And you see that dysfunction as the removal of capitalism. And I wonder, you know, Bell Hooks talks about the three prongs, the white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy. Do you see all of those as connected as well?
Yeah. I mean, they are. Those are the tools that created the modern civilization. The capitalism is about the consolidation of wealth and resources for the interest of the profiteers and the owners and the rulers and the elite, the top percentile, the most wealthy are the ones who are going to control the army that invades to secure the resources that are extracted. The army that kills the people to separate the people from the land where the resources are being extracted from, and the political system that is ruled by male patriarchal interests to control the earth and impose social controls and codes and behavior on the populace for the purpose of keeping the extracted wealth flowing towards reinforcing their power that is maintained through violence. So to me, that's what capitalism, white supremacy, and patriarchy looks like. And we know that there are other regions of the world where people that aren't of Western European descent, but they still participate in these systems. So one could argue that there's a human element to the way we've organized under the dominant systems of oppression that transcends whiteness. But I'll say that in modern history, it's been the consolidation and creation of whiteness as a political, economic, and military force that has had taken ideological root in identities of people for different reasons throughout history, that it became more advantageous for whiteness to operate as an organized force of oppression against other people to protect the interests of a small group of white people, but that in creating a kind of buffer class of white people who had certain privileges that were excluded, that other people were excluded from accessing, you created almost an army of people who are going to fight to protect their entitlement that's attached to their white identity. And that's what, when we see the term Make America Great Again, and we see this kind of nationalistic, patriarchal identity that's actually a political force and a violent force. That's what the USA is. We see this across Europe as well, you know. So you can't have one without the other, and it's an easy connection for me, but I can understand where it seems like a bit of a stretch for some people, because we haven't been taught to analyze things in a radical way and look at the different root causes as part of the same thing, you know. And we've been taught, many of us in this society, we've been taught that the privileges that we do have here that are actually the byproduct of this extraction and oppression, we've been taught to think that those are the best lives, that the things that we have access to here as consumers have given us a standard of living that's the best on earth. And so we become so dependent and reliant on these things that we become afraid to lose them. And we think that, and we've been taught to think the whole time that nobody has it as good as us, and that if we don't follow the rules, then we'll wind up being like those people who are starving in a third world country and who are experiencing terrorism, when the reality is there are other ways to live that are less sick. You know? But the problem is that the police still exist. And one, something that not many people are talking about, especially in media, although some of us are having these conversations in private, is what happens when we see the retaliation of the police, that their response to the uprisings has been escalated violence and repression. They're going after activists, they're targeting activists in different areas. And so what we see and we have to be aware of is that the police as an organized culture and force is going to respond to the threat of the abolishment of their livelihoods with, they're going to pivot, and they're going to be, some of them are going to be on some organized vigilante stuff, you know, and that's something we have to contend with. And it's scary and it sucks, but it's a problem that we're going to have to face. That I anticipate further retaliation and escalation of force as that arm of white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, protection of private property, putting the value of property over the lives of people, that is under threat, because the people know that we're tired of that being a threatening force against our lives. So in uprising and in rebellion, we're going to emerge with the desire to abolish that, the most radical among us. And we're going to have to organize. And as we start to organize and move in that direction, they're going to respond.
And on that note, I think we're going to leave it. Thank you so much, Mike Crenshaw, for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you, Jenka.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio.
What about the good Lord and the heavens up above? The heavens up above, they are inside of you. Don't forget about the essence of the message right in through. And to the hell below, we have access to that too. Depending on what you know, what you think, and what you do. I'm posted on the radio, still surveillance with my crew. With a phone and from the drone, they spy on me and you. Oh, you think you cool? They spying on you too. I know you think I'm a fool, but they're spying on you too. So what you gonna do? What we gonna do? What you gonna do? What we gonna do?
It's time to think fast.
Come on, man.
Learn lessons from my past.
Come on, man.
Organize the draft.
The movement.
Solidarity at last.
The movement.
Hey, yo, it's time to think fast.
The movement.
Do not run. Do not run.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder, board operator.
Today I am interviewing Andrew Epperson. He has had problems with a wheelchair company, and we will be discussing it today. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, John.
So, Andrew, can you explain to me the problems you were having with your wheelchair?
Yeah, John. So, it's an issue where several parts have went out, the motors, actuator, show out the chair. 2.5 years, it's probably spent the bulk of a year and some months in the shop.
And how much difficulty has that, with your wheelchair, in the shop, that must have reduced your mobility, your socialization, and your independence by, at least a little bit.
Quite a lot, actually, because I only use my power chair, so I'm essentially homebound.
That must interfere with your overall. Does that interfere with your health and stuff like that as well? When you're homebound, does that kind of like? I guess what I'm trying to get at is does it interfere with your ability to get out there and get some exercise, some sunlight, to go grocery shopping, and all the things you kind of need to do to keep on living from day to day.
Yeah, absolutely it does. Currently, of course, we're all dealing with the pandemic that's going on. While it is different because of my own fault, it's much the same symptom for me where, I'm not leaving the house, I can't grocery shopping, I can't easily get to a doctor. Luckily, I have doctors that come in home, largely because of situations like this. They're like, well, you're homebound more than you're not, so we are going to go ahead and qualify for the program. And I have providers, but they're home with me trying to keep the spirits up as best they can. I'm not great for anyone's mental health to have no exposure to socialize or get sunlight or put your head, have some fun, all that stuff stops when it cares. So I would say physically and mentally it should be addressed in a much better fashion so that doesn't happen.
And when you say addressed in a much better fashion,
the time that it takes a company that is replacing the parts to get the parts approved by the insurance and process their own paperwork.
And I take it.
My last parts took 4 months.
4 months?
That
seems ludicrously, ridiculously long.
Yeah. My last set of motors were like 5 months because someone went on vacation at the insurance company and they're like, oh, sorry, the person who handled that's gone, so we didn't. It didn't get pushed through. We got it now. The wheelchair companies can only hold the parts for so long, then they can set it back, and the whole thing.
You've been just dealing with one wheelchair company, or what? And
other than out-of-pocket rental, which is a whole other thing to talk about, because I have a specialized chair.
Yeah.
The chair isn't almost exactly the same type of chair that I have.
Uh-huh.
Legally, they can't give me anything to rent on insurance. So last time I tried to rent one cash, but my chair is so me specific that the chair that I rented, which ended up costing like $400 for a month, didn't even work. So they took it back after a week and charged me a week, which was like $100.
And you had to pay for this all out of your pocket.
Yeah, because they won't, the insurance won't cover a chair that doesn't come from one of their contract companies. So there was two companies that could come from, New Motion and another company. And if they don't have a class 3 wheelchair, which is a really specialized wheelchair where I have assistance tills and everything else that I need, then they just don't have it if you don't get it.
And being that you need a specialized wheelchair, I am kind of curious, does it cause health problems when you have to rent a wheelchair that's not customized to you?
Oh, yeah, because I have been a state. It's just basically issues with veins in my legs. So I get edema, which is just another word for swelling in my leg, fluid. So if I can't tilt and my legs hang all day, that's a problem.
Andrew, what were some of the worst issues that you had with this company?
I guess the biggest one to stick out would be lack of communication. That they weren't good about telling me where we were in the process of getting the part. They weren't good about taking accountability for what paperwork they should have had done, letting me know when it was on their side.
And have you heard of anybody else who's had problems with this company?
Oh my. Yeah. Just on my Facebook friends list alone, I can think of 3 to 4 people.
3 to 4 people?
Yeah. In fact, a friend, she got 2 different sets of motors, 1 different motor on each side, and it took multiple months for them to remedy that with technicians coming out.
Wow. Just out of curiosity, it shouldn't normally take that long to have a wheelchair motor repaired. What would you say? I mean, obviously a couple of months is pretty long to have for anybody to take to repair something. What would you say would be reasonable?
What you and I believe is reasonable is not what typical. I guess typical would be somewhere between a month to 3 months, because it all depends on how long the wheelchair company takes to process their side of things, and the insurance company takes to process their side of things, and that's what makes things kind of string along where they take longer. But the process for payments is way too long. And they don't, by they, I mean the wheelchair company and the insurance company, don't account for the damage that's being done while you're taking.
It sounds like the bureaucracy is kind of doing a lot of damage? Or...
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the insurance company, so they'll take time to decide if they want to process an order, like for motors, whatever part of it. And as they're doing that, there's other issues being caused by not having a chair. And they had to start sending out full health in your suit because I can't really reach home without a chair, and the issues still need to be dealt with and looked at. So while they're complaining about the money they're spending to remedy the cost of the chair and not wanting to speed things up, they're spending upwards of probably, I think the last statement I saw was around $1,300 a month for, I mean, granted, some of that was care supplies, but they're spending a significant amount of money to have that nurse come out when they should pay a little bit more money and probably express the part.
Well, isn't it always with the system that they take the longest, most complicated, and more expensive route rather than doing things the right way?
In general, yeah, that's been my experience, especially with durable medical equipment. It's just the entire process broken from, you know, whether it's from the dealer or the manufacturer of the chair or the insurance company, the way they process it, it's just completely broken.
Yeah, tell me about it. The whole system when it comes to disabilities is broken in half.
Great.
Obviously, during this downtime, when your wheelchair is not functioning, you still have to deal with life and life problems and stuff like that. And how do you manage to get that stuff done without your wheelchair, I guess was what I'm asking. Yes.
I'm entirely dependent, basically, because I can't go anywhere unless I'm in with a medical appointment. I could be in medical transit and be, if I had to be, I could be journeyed to a doctor's appointment. As far as anything else, I'm either doing it electronically, you know, anything I can pay online, I'm paying fine. Or I have, you know, support providers doing different tasks for me. But yeah, I mean, I'm stuck at home. There's nothing else I can do about it but try to speed the process along.
How complicated is this pandemic making other things?
It's made things more complicated. My provider, when available, gets some things picked up for me, like some prescriptions and stuff, but it also requires a lot of grocery delivery because it's really the only option to replace things that are missing.
Hey, Andrew, I understand you're a self-advocate. Do you mind telling me what you're passionate about advocating for?
Good job, you're happy to. You know, one of the bigger things I've been trying to advocate for is obviously better management of durable medical equipment, wheelchairs, hospital beds, things like that, better coverage, better turnaround time, that sort of thing. And secondarily, also, wheelchair accessible transportation, because while yes, the bus is available, it doesn't work for everyone. Yes, providers are available, but 95% of them don't have a vehicle that can load a motorized wheelchair. That's difficult. The Lyft TriMet system, a lot of times a long wait on reach and pickup, and can be distressing for certain conditions. And taxis are a long wait and expensive. So it's general accessible transportation is just, it's expensive and time consuming. So those are my two big, I guess you could call them passion projects, but also they're my necessities, and I know there's a limitations of many other people in the disability community.
Yeah, I really want to thank you for, you know, getting in and advocating in the in those areas. We need all the self-advocates we can get and all the voices we can get to constantly tell the legislation, both federal, state, all the governments, county, city, all that, about, hey, what we need to make us productive and, you know, what we need to make us really good citizens and stuff like that.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it might seem like the, you know, the silent minority for a while, but, you know, over time, it seems like any cause gets a vocal minority, and they have to hear you eventually. So we'll certainly get where we need to be with things now.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for getting in there and lending your voice to ours. And also really, really like to, you know, if you got the time and you want to do it and it seems worthwhile to you, we do have self-advocates taking action every second Friday of the month from 11 to 1. And we can do Zoom. So, I mean... you know, feel free to join us.
Yeah, I'd love to.
People with disabilities often get the shaft end of things.
A lot of isolation.
Yeah, see, I've experienced an awful lot of that myself. I mean, everybody looks at me and says, you seem pretty sociable, but trust me, there's When you're a person with a disability, you spend a large portion of your time in your own thoughts and in your own brain and alone.
And sometimes that's not the best place to be.
No, it really isn't. It really isn't. I want to thank you for sharing that with me, by the way.
Happy to.
So, Andrew, is there anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, so going back to our earlier touch on the pandemic, I did want to share something that I thought was wildly mismanaged and incorrect for several people in the disability community, and also, frankly, the elder community. So you're familiar with the $1,200 stimulus checks, I assume?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so if someone is living with their parent, whether they're elderly or disabled, or really anyone, living with anyone, and they happen to be claimed on their taxes as a dependent, a lot of tax places will advise you to claim them as an adult dependent because it sometimes gets tax breaks of some kind. And when you do that, it's generally not a problem if you don't get it. But in the case of the pandemic, because I was kind of a dependent, the IRS plus federal government decided that I don't need a stimulus check because I'm financially dependent. But where that becomes an issue for me is this. Under the rules of SFI, no one is supposed to give me any assistance with, you know, income, cash, gift cards, rental assistance, food assistance, and, you know, pretty much anything. So I'm not really sure how they can say, oh, well, you're someone's tax dependent, so you don't need this money, but also they better not give you any money. And it's not as if they gave them a $500 child credit. They just zeroed out my ability to get any funds whatsoever.
Wait a minute. Let me see if I get this correct. You don't get enough money to survive as is, but yet when it came down to the stimulus check, if you'd gotten it, you would have gotten penalized for it?
No. So because I'm claimed by someone in my home as a tax dependent, they zeroed out my stimulus check debt. So I didn't get it. And if I was underage, my parent would have got the $500. But because I'm an adult, they didn't give them anything and they didn't give me anything. They just zeroed it out. And that also happens if you're elderly and living in a loved one's home because you need care and they claim you're dependent, and you also can get money.
Holy crap. You got this whole stimulus, you got nothing either way.
Right.
That seems wrong.
Yeah, it definitely felt wrong, especially with having extra costs related to the pandemic. But they think because we're receiving the sum that they give us monthly, that our costs have been done. They all check on.
Yeah, but I mean, even the monthly amount of money that they give you is still pretty small. You know, I know because I get a monthly sum of money, and it trust me, it doesn't stretch. It really just doesn't stretch.
No, it definitely does not adjust for the cost of living.
And it sounds to me like they didn't give you the $1,200 or even a $500 thing, and even if they had, that still is too small to really kind of, I mean, it would have helped, but it's still pretty small considering, how much you've got to stretch it out for.
Change the rules around someone giving me money or any kind of support, so I don't know why it changes my ability to receive it just because I'm a tax dependent. Like, that was clearly, to me, it was just personal opinion, not fact. But to me, I felt like disabled and elderly people were made as the bargaining chip to pass the legislation. That's the way it comes across.
Yeah, and that seems, considering they gave out $1.4 billion to people who are already dead, I'm just like, you could have taken that $1.4 billion and turned around and given it to people who have a disability and helped them out a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of places left to go and help. Luckily, they did give stimulus checks to houseless people and people in long-term care homes, or at least someone has experienced, because I have a friend who's in a long-term care home, and they did receive stimulus checks, so I was glad to see that, but it's like, I about being somewhat tax-dependent makes you less financially weak.
Yeah, and it also kind of, I mean, it's sort of like the government slapping you in the face and saying, we don't care about you.
Yeah, that's definitely how it felt. I was definitely beyond frustrated. You know, I went through that for a while, but then, you move forward and you start advocating.
Yeah, and like I said, we really look forward to having your voice at the table, and we really hope to see you, at Self Advocates Taking Action, and who knows, maybe we can set up Zoom meetings and get you down in Salem.
Yeah, that sounds like a good thing to get together on, and I think we'll definitely make some awesome progress.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Andrew, for letting us interview you. and taking the time out of your busy schedule to tell us about the difficulties you're having in your life.
Absolutely, John. I was happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
Thank you. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
On July 1st, 2020, Palestinians called for their supporters around the world to engage in a day of rage against Israel's recent effort to annex or fully colonize Palestinian land.